Now, the big read.
The Extraordinary Patience of Things. This beautiful place defaced with a crop of suburban houses. How beautiful when we first beheld it. Unbroken field of poppy and lupin, walled with clean cliffs. No intrusion but two or three horses pasturing, or a few milch cows rubbing their flanks on the outcrop rockheads. Now the spoiler has come. Does it care? Not faintly. It has all time. It knows the people are a tide that swells and in time will ebb, and all their works dissolve. Meanwhile, the image of the pristine beauty lives in the very grain of the granite, safe as the endless ocean that climbs our cliff. As for us, we must uncenter our minds from ourselves. We must unhumanize our views a little and become confident as the rock and ocean that we were made from.
That was radio and television host Robert Aubrey Davis reading Robinson Jeffers' Carmel Point. Welcome to The Big Read, a program created by the National Endowment for the Arts. The largest reading program in American history, The Big Read is designed to unite communities through great literature. I'm Josephine Reed. Today, poet and former chair of the NEA, Dana Gioia, will discuss Robinson Jeffers as part of our American Literary Landmark series, a celebration of the nation's great poets and the historic houses that inform their work. Here's Dana Gioia.
John Robinson Jeffers, the great poet of the American West, was born in the suburbs of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. His father, William Hamilton Jeffers, was a professor of Old Testament biblical theology and a Presbyterian minister. A strict disciplinarian and serious intellectual, the elder Jeffers was a middle-aged widower when he met and courted Annie Tuttle, 22 years his junior. Robinson was the first of their two sons. His father determined that his older son should be properly educated and gave him rigorous private lessons in Greek, Latin, and religion. In 1898, the family journeyed overseas where the young Jeffers was enrolled first in a German school in Leipzig and then, the following year, in a French school in Switzerland. By the time he was 12, Jeffers was fluent in French, German, Greek, Latin, and English, but awkward with other children. Not surprisingly, the boy developed complex feelings towards his deeply loving but authoritarian father, whose image haunts the many tragic patriarchs who figure in Jeffers' later narrative poems. Jeffers entered the University of Pittsburgh at 15 as a sophomore. When his father retired the next year and the family moved to Los Angeles, Jeffers transferred to Occidental College, where he graduated in 1905 at the age of 17. Entering graduate school at the University of Southern California, the precocious teenager eventually did graduate work at several universities in literature, medicine, and forestry, but gradually realized that poetry was his calling. At USC, Jeffers met Una Call Custer, a beautiful woman who was not only 3 years his senior, but married to a wealthy local attorney. Robinson and Una fell passionately in love. After 7 years of guilt-ridden romance with many renunciations, separations, reconciliations, and eventually a public scandal reported in the Los Angeles Times, Una obtained a divorce on August 1st. 1913. The next day, she and Jeffers married. By now, Jeffers had dedicated himself fully to poetry. His first collection, Flagons and Apples, had appeared in 1912, but the restless young writer had already improved beyond his early volume of rhymed love lyrics. He and Una traveled north on a horse-drawn mail coach to the wild Big Sur region of coastal California, where the road ended. They rented a small cabin in the village of Carmel, which they recognized as their inevitable place. Jeffers later remembered, "For the first time in my life, I could see people living amid magnificent unspoiled scenery as they did in the Idylls or the Sagas or in Homer's Ithaca. Here was a contemporary life that was also permanent life." The 27-year-old poet knew that he had not yet written anything of enduring value. The death of both his father and his own newborn daughter in 1914 heightened his sense of mortality. After issuing a second collection, Californians, in 1916, Jeffers published nothing for 8 years. He divided his time between writing and building a stone house, eventually complete with a tower, for his family, which now included twin sons, on a promontory or tor overlooking the Pacific. The building of the home became a lifelong pursuit. In the following poem, Tor House, Jeffers wrote about the home in which he would write all of his major poems.
If you should look for this place after a handful of lifetimes, perhaps of my planted forest, a few may stand yet, dark-leaved Australians, or the coast cypress, haggard with storm drift. But fire and the axe are devils. Look for foundations of sea-worn granite. My fingers had the art to make stone love stone. You will find some remnant. But if you should look in your idleness after 10,000 years, it is the granite knoll on the granite and lava tongue in the midst of the bay, by the mouth of the Carmel River Valley. These four will remain in the change of names. You will know it by the wild sea fragrance of wind, though the ocean may have climbed or retired a little. You will know it by the valley inland that our sun and our moon were born from before the poles changed. And Orion in December evenings was strung in the throat of the valley like a lamp-lighted bridge. Come in the morning, you will see white gulls weaving a dance over blue water, the wane of the moon, their dance companion, a ghost walking by daylight, but wider and whiter than any bird in the world. My ghost you needn't look for. It is probably here, but a dark one, deep in the granite, not dancing on wind with the mad wings and the day moon.
During his retreat from publication after Californians, Jeffers carefully reconsidered his aims as a poet and underwent a slow but radical transformation. He rejected rhyme and traditional meter, which inhibited him from telling a story flexibly in verse. He also rejected the obscurity of modernist poetry. "It became clear to me," he wrote, "that poetry, if it were to survive at all, must reclaim some of the power and reality that it has so hastily surrendered to prose." He determined to write a timeless and truthful poetry purged of ephemeral things. In 1924, Jeffers published Tamar and Other Poems with a small vanity press in New York. This volume pronounced Jeffers mature in style, form, subject, and theme. The book even took the characteristic shape of most of his subsequent volumes, a long narrative poem followed by a group of shorter lyrics and meditative poems. Tamar attracted no initial notice, but a year later it was suddenly taken up by several influential critics. Jeffers produced an expanded trade edition containing what would be his most famous narrative poem, Roan Stallion. Both public and critical opinions were extraordinary, and Roan Stallion, Tamar, and Other Poems went into multiple reprintings. From that collection, here is Shine, Perishing Republic.
while this America settles in the mold of its vulgarity, heavily thickening to empire. And protest, only a bubble in the molten mass, pops and sighs out, and the mass hardens. I, sadly smiling, remember that the flower fades to make fruit. The fruit rots to make earth. Out of the mother, and through the spring exultances, ripeness and decadence, and home to the mother. You making haste, haste on decay, not blameworthy. Life is good, be it stubbornly long or suddenly immortal splendor. Meteors are not needed less than mountains. Shine, perishing republic. But for my children, I would have them keep their distance from the thickening center. Corruption never has been compulsory. When the cities lie at the monster's feet, there are left the mountains. And boys, be in nothing so moderate as in love of man, a clever servant, insufferable master. There is the trap that catches noblest spirits, the caught, they say, God, when he walked on earth.
Praising his narrative energy, stylistic originality, and thematic profundity, critics compared him to Sophocles and Shakespeare. But Jeffers ignored his sudden celebrity and focused on his work. Over the next 10 years, he published 8 collections containing the most remarkable, ambitious, and odd narrative poems in American literature. From 1927's The Women at Point Sur to Such Counsels You Give Me, published a decade later, nearly every volume centers on a long narrative, usually set in or around Big Sur. Violent, sexual, philosophical, and subversive, these are novels in verse. Their tragic stories of family rivalry and primal emotion usually move with determined pace to a bloody finale. In sheer narrative energy and visual scope, they resemble movies. Not real ones, but imaginary cinema where high and low art collide. The poems reveal Jeffers' obsessions, such as the suffocating burden of the past, often in the form of religious dogmatism, patriotic hypocrisy, or social convention, bearing down to destroy human freedom. Alternately magnificent and hyperbolic, powerful and excessive, dramatic and overblown, they are unlike anything else in modernist American poetry. Almost immediately, Jeffers' long narrative poems divided audiences. His explicit sexuality, violent plots, and overt anti-Christianity alienated conservative readers. Leftists were dismayed by his distrust of all political programs for human improvement. Meanwhile, the New Critics perceived Jeffers' commitment to poetry of direct statement, expansive treatment, and linear narrative as a rejection of the compressed, indirect, and lyric high-modernist mode they had all championed. He rarely found a place in academic anthologies, and his critical reception increasingly tended to be hostile. The controversy over Jeffers' longer narratives unfortunately overshadowed his shorter works, tucked in the back pages of each new book. These lyric meditations, generally written in long, rhythmic free verse lines, marked a new kind of nature poem that tried to describe the physical world not from a human perspective, but on its own terms. Humanity, he insisted, was an integral part of nature, not its master. Not man apart, was his phrase, which became a famous rallying cry among environmentalists and conservationists who consider him a seminal figure in the movement to protect natural habitat, wilderness, and coastal land. Jeffers' nature poetry is emotionally direct, magnificently musical, and philosophically profound. His language is strong, concise, and timeless. His ideas are boldly expressed in memorable images. In poems such as Evening Ebb, nature itself is the subject.
The ocean has not been so quiet for a long while. Five night herons fly shore-long, voiceless in the hush of the air, over the calm of an ebb that almost mirrors their wings. The sun has gone down, and the water has gone down from the weed-clad rock, but the distant cloud wall rises. The ebb whispers. Great cloud shadows float in the opal water. Through rifts in the screen of the world, pale gold gleams, and the evening star suddenly glides like a flying torch. As if we had not been meant to see her, rehearsing behind the screen of the world for another audience.
The poems unfold as clearly as prose, without the indirection common to the work of more overtly modernist poets like Pound, Eliot, and Moore, who were his contemporaries. But by World War II, Jeffers' critical reputation had collapsed and would not rise again until after his death. The Depression and war had made his cosmic fatalism and distrust of all political systems less palatable to intellectuals caught up in tragic international events. To the disgust of many Americans, he opposed America's entry into World War II, warning that the conflict would turn the United States into an imperial power. Jeffers still commanded a large group of serious readers, and his books sold very well, but the literary establishment, dominated by new critics on the right and Marxists on the left, had rejected him. The poet's complete rejection of public literary life exacerbated the situation. Hating big cities, Jeffers hardly stirred from Carmel. He would not teach or lecture. He scarcely answered his mail. Remote from the centers of literary power in London and New York, he seemed indifferent to his slowly declining reputation. In 1945, however, the noted actress Judith Anderson asked the poet to translate and adapt a classical tragedy by Euripides for the modern stage. When Jeffers' Medea opened on Broadway in 1947, it stunned audiences and critics with its power and intensity. New York Times critic Brooke Atkinson called it a landmark in theater. Medea played to sold-out houses, a national touring company was soon formed, and productions were staged across Europe. As its frequent revivals have demonstrated, it is one of the finest adaptations of classical drama in English. Medea's success relieved Jeffers' financial worries, but the happiest days of his life were now behind him. After Una's slow death from cancer in 1950, Jeffers sank into a prolonged depression aggravated by heavy drinking. His eyesight failed. He continued writing, but with less energy and little savor. Jeffers published only one book during the last 14 years of his life, Hungerfield and Other Poems in 1954. The title poem is a violent and nightmarish narrative that ends unexpectedly with an authorial interruption, Jeffers' heartbreaking invocation to his dead wife. A few days after his 75th birthday, he died in his sleep at Torhouse. As Scottish poet George Macbeth observed, Jeffers is one of the few American poets of the 20th century who can be approached in terms of his ideas rather than technique. His poetic technique was both strong and original, but once he had developed his style in the mid-1920s, he never significantly altered it. Unlike his modernist contemporaries, Jeffers was not interested in poetry as an exploration of language's ability to describe its own processes. Language itself, as Robert Haas commented, is simply not one of Jeffers' subjects. Jeffers' philosophy has frequently been called pessimistic, but that term seems vague and misleading. Trained in the sciences, Jeffers took a coldly rational view of humanity's small place in the cosmos. He called his new philosophical stance inhumanism, a term that has been much misunderstood. It does not endorse cruelty or inhumanity in the common sense of the word. Jeffers' inhumanism is a simple but radical realignment of moral values, which he describes as a shifting of emphasis and significance from man to not man. In Vulture, the speaker considers the wider, greater perspective of nature.
I had walked since dawn and lay down to rest on a bare hillside above the ocean. I saw through half-shut eyelids a vulture wheeling high up in heaven, and presently it passed again, but lower and nearer, its orbit narrowing. I understood then that I was under inspection. I lay death still and heard the flight feathers whistle above me and make their circle and come nearer. I could see the naked red head between the great wings, bare downward, staring. I said, "My dear bird, we are wasting time here. These old bones will still work. They are not for you." But how beautiful he looked, gliding down on those great sails. How beautiful he looked, veering away in the sea light over the precipice. I tell you solemnly that I was sorry to have disappointed him. To be eaten by that beak and become part of him, to share those wings and those eyes, what a sublime end of one's body, what an enskyment, what a life after death.
Humanity was not, Jeffers felt, the measure of all things. It was merely one species, albeit the triumphantly dominant one, but it neither understood its place nor its responsibility to the world. Overpopulation, urbanization, pollution, and industrialization would have dire consequences on the planet, Jeffers warned in his prophetic poems. What saves Jeffers' poetry from unrelieved bitterness and nihilism is its joyful awe and indeed religious devotion to the natural world. Living on the edge of the Pacific, he drew wisdom, strength, and perspective from observing the forces of nature around him. In Rock and Hawk, he offers yet another image of a bird, this time the image of a falcon perched on its tall coastal rock as a symbol of the proper human values. Rock and Hawk. Here is a symbol in which many high tragic thoughts watch their own eyes. This gray rock, standing tall on the headland, where the sea wind lets no tree grow, earthquake proved and signatured by ages of storms, on its peak, a falcon has perched. I think here is your emblem to hang in the future sky. Not the cross, not the hive, but this bright power, dark peace, fierce consciousness joined with final disinterestedness, life with calm death, the falcon's realist eyes and act married to the massive mysticism of stone, which failure cannot cast down, nor success make proud. That unusual combination of sensual delight and stoical resolve underlies much of Jeffers' best work. Magnificent, troubling, idiosyncratic, and uneven, Jeffers remains the great prophetic voice of American modernism.
Thanks for joining The Big Read. This program was created by the National Endowment for the Arts in partnership with the Institute of Museum and Library Services. The introduction to the poetry of Robinson Jeffers has been made possible in part with support from the Poetry Foundation. It was written and narrated by Dana Gioia. Robert Aubrey Davis read the poetry of Robinson Jeffers, which is used courtesy of Stanford University Press. Pepper Smith produced the show with assistance from Adam Campy and Liz Mahaffey. Excerpts from Bach's Cello Suite No. 4, performed by Alexander Rudin, used courtesy of Naxos of America, Incorporated. Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 28, Opus 101, performed by Seymour Lipkin, used courtesy of Newport Classic. Mandan Heartbreak Song, arranged by Jovino Santos Neto. Warrior's Return, performed by Keith Baer. And Traces of Hope, written and performed by Gary Stratsos and Jovino Santos Neto, all from the CD People of the Willows and used courtesy of Makoche Recording Company. Thanks to Ted Libby, Erica Koss, and Howard Bass. I'm the executive producer, Josephine Reed, for the National Endowment for the Arts. Thanks for listening. For more information about The Big Read, go to www.neabigread.org. That's www.neabigread.org.